Swamiji has often told us personal incidents that he had during the years that he lived with Yogananda. Many of them are written in the various books that he's, in fact, all of them are written in one or another of the books that he's published, but some of them are worth highlighting here today. I was specifically remembering a story that Swami tells at some length in The New Path, where he talks about an Indian man who came to visit Yogananda in Los Angeles. Now, you have to remember the context. Excuse me. This was the end of the 1940s into the early 1950s. Master died in 1952, March 7th, 1952. And there weren't very many Indian teachers in America, just a handful, and there wasn't this great unity of India and America, which has become so common, especially where we live. So his being in this country was very unusual. So, and there's another reality that has to be taken into mind, how very integrated the social world in India was. Certain castes, certain ethnicities, certain social groups. And even now, as all of you who are associated with India know, the interrelationships of family, the obligation to family, the necessity to be hospitable, it's just the given. It's the way the culture works, and it's one of the wonderful aspects of the culture. When a friend of mine was here and he needed to deliver a message to someone down in San Jose, I was saying, well, I can deliver it for you. Oh, no, he said. Absolutely unacceptable. I must go myself. My mother would never forgive me if I didn't go myself. So people would come and stay at Mount Washington who had various links to Master, and the friend of a friend or the friend of a relative came to stay, and he was going to stay for 2 weeks, and then he stayed for 2 months, and he complained about the food that was there, that it was too Western for his taste, so Master started sending him meals out of his own kitchen and just took care of him like a brother and like a friend, without any sense of imposition, but this just is the man, this is what I have to do. The guest is God, is an Indian principle. And I believe it was this same man, if I have this accurately, who fancied himself to be a dancer, is how Swami described it, although his dancing was more in the boxing ring rather than actually dancing. But he wanted to put on a performance. So he made this huge arrangement, and he had live musicians, and he was there to dance, and it was a solitary performance pantomiming a hunter searching for the deer, the triumph of the hunt, and so on like this. And Swamiji said he was simply terrible. There was really no other way to describe him. He was just awful. He was out of step with the musicians. He was clumsy. He lacked everything that a dancer should have. He also lacked a sense of time. His sense of time seemingly embraced eternity, is how Swami described it. And so there was the triumphant hunter, then he played the deer, and then the deer finally the hunter gets to the deer and kills the deer, and the audience thinks that this is just about over. But as Swamiji said, we forgot about the death throes of the deer. So then there's the death throes of the deer, then there's the triumphant march of the hunter. And finally, one of the musicians motions to the curtain, people pulling the curtain to bring the curtain down. So the curtain comes down right over him. And Swami said, the last thing you see is the man's legs stomping off like this to give a piece of his mind to the man who brought the curtain down on him. Now, Swamiji said he's sitting there with Master through this whole performance. And Master had a keen sense of humor and just enjoyed, you know, just the absurdity of the whole situation. And Swamiji, of course, too, being very artistic also. But they had to control themselves. And Swamiji started to laugh a little out loud. And Master, sort of just barely restraining himself, said, don't, meaning that if either of us gives in to our hilarity, there'll just be no stopping it. He said virtually tears are running down their faces with the effort to restrain their hilarious enjoyment of this experience. Now, that alone was just fun, about how Master could see the absurd side of things. But Swami then finishes the story, that later the man comes up to Master and starts talking to him about how difficult it was to perform well because the musicians weren't competent and they weren't keeping the rhythm, and, you know, how we suffer for our art. And Master with complete sincerity, said to him, "I understand." And just without the slightest bit of judgment or comment about anything that you might think he would have said, he said, "I understand." And Swamiji, you know, being the exquisite interpreter of Master's words and understanding how every word that came out of Master's mouth was exactly what it was meant to be, as Swamiji said, and he did understand. He understood every aspect of it. The man's pretensions to be an artist, his desire to perform, his feeling that people weren't treating him right, and also the folly of his whole egoic fantasy that he was playing it out. In those two words, "I understand," Master said everything. Now, it's very hard for us to conceive, just as Swami was writing in the commentary that Nirmoha and David read for us. It's very hard for us even to imagine how someone can love like that. And Swami writes, "Honestly, we all loved Master from varying degrees of ego identification. But the love he gave us was purely the love of God." Now, these masters come to personify this reality, as the Bhagavad Gita describes. They incarnate again and again because it is literally impossible. Well, in the words, when Master's describing samadhi, he uses the phrase enjoyable beyond imagination of expectancy. Beautiful crafting of language. But that's exactly what it is. How much God loves us is beyond our ability even to imagine. So the masters move through this world from time to time, and they, even though their bodies come and go, they leave this trail behind them of this possibility of perfect love. This is what the heart, every one of us, no matter how we mask it, whether it's an ambition to serve the world or to be wealthy or to have a beautiful home or whatever it might be, all of it deep inside of us is this desire to be seen, to be recognized, to be understood. I remember a woman whose wedding we performed was trying to explain her attraction to her husband. She used the vernacular, the slang word, "He gets me," is how she put it. And by that she meant he somehow understands who I am. But yet all of us know, even in the closest relationships, with a baby, with a child, with a husband or a wife, there's always that moment where you realize, no matter how sincere, no matter how kind, no matter how good, I still stand alone before God, and only He really understands who I am. A friend of mine was going through a very difficult emotional disappointment, relationships, the same old story. I remember Honnell Cassidy, who was this very distinguished gentleman who was part of Ananda Village in the 70s. He'd had quite an international career as a photographer. He was a ballroom dancer in New York. He was in his 70s when he came to Ananda to teach us organic gardening. And he had a whole philosophy of life that he would, at the drop of a hat, explain to us. We were so barbaric, and he was so refined. We were just these wild barefoot hippies, and he was this completely impeccable, even gardening, his clothes were always pressed. But he said, the great tragedy of life, he said, is that A loves B, but B loves C, and C loves D, he said. And no matter how hard they try, they never get it straightened out. I've always vividly remembered that. Well, my poor friend was caught in A loving B and B loving C. And he was sharing with me advice that had been given to him by another friend who'd been through it and said, "You know, my, that relationship fell apart and I thought I'd never recover. But later on, God sent me someone so much better." And my friend was saying to me, sort of trying to integrate that as a way to comfort himself, I said, ah, but what if God never sends someone better? What then? Now, maybe God will. I said, there is a happy ending to the story, but it's not the happy ending that, oh, finally, all of my little ducks line up just right, and I do get to do the performance, and the curtain stays up until the end, and then everybody applauds. But what if they don't? I said, you can't comfort yourself with more delusion. Because sooner or later, that delusion is going to roll out, and that too is going to fall apart. Maybe, in fact, God will send someone nicer. This life, next life, and then that person will die, or A will fall in love with B, and there you'll be, just hanging out again, wondering. The only solution, the only final solution, and this is how Master was speaking when he was talking on the speaker to us today. He said, I work hard, service is necessary, I give everything I can to this world. All day long I'm totally involved. He said, but my heart belongs to God. And he was involved in being a Swami and setting up a monastic order and all those things. We may be involved in being a husband or a wife or a mother or a devoted child or whatever it might be. But in the midst of it, above all, our heart must belong to God for only one reason. Otherwise, we will be hurt. Because you see, everything in this world eventually just balances out. It's just waves on the ocean. Now it goes well. Swamiji was commenting about a friend of ours whose life just seemed to be charmed. Everything seemed to work. And, oh, quote, effortlessly. And Swamiji said, ah, yes, but you don't see all the lifetimes it took to come to that. And Swami, once someone was coming to Swami and saying, oh, I'd like to have a marriage like so-and-so has, you know, this beautiful couple that we all know. I'd like to have a marriage like that. Swami was supportive. I understand. But then later he said to me, it takes many, many lifetimes before you come to a relationship like that. You see, it's all just happening in the way it needs to happen. And I was thinking, it needs to happen for our salvation and for our ultimate happiness. We always want the quick and dirty solution, don't we? Just the cheap one. We set up a printing company once and we were trying to set the prices, and there was the canary version of printing, which was cheap, cheap. Because there is something in printing, in what used to be printing, everything's different now, called quick and dirty. You just do it fast and it's cheap, cheap. No refinement to it. We're very often trying to bargain with God, aren't we? We just want the cheap, cheap solution. We want the pain to end now. It's like Swamiji said when he was a child in Romania, their medical care was a little primitive and they didn't have Novocaine, and he had bad teeth because he had colitis, he couldn't take milk. But sometimes the dentist felt bad for him when he was drilling, so he stopped drilling before he really cleaned out the teeth and then just put a filling on top of it. That's not true love. And so we're in that situation with Master. He's drilling down, really just trying to clear it out before he puts the crown of bliss on top of us. And we say, no, no, stop now, just put the crown on. You know, just give us a cheap one. It doesn't matter. But he loves us too much. You know, that's the good news. That's the bad news. And God is so impersonal about our reality. It's very hard for us to understand. One of my favorite incomprehensibles from Master was when he said, people make the mistake of thinking that everything that happens to them concerns them personally. Isn't that marvelous? Of course it concerns me personally. Who else does it concern? We all loved Master from various degrees of ego identification. It is happening. It's the karmic cycle that is necessary for the energies that this jiva has put in motion. In the 60s and the 70s, when people would take a lot of drugs and get really, really confused, really, really confused, they would paste on top of their ordinary, perfectly ordinary consciousness, all this mystical vocabulary. And a lot of them would come to Ananda Village and they would sort of wander through our retreat. We had this wonderful lady who came, and she was from the Pleiades. or from Venus. Actually, I think she was from Venus. She was from Venus. She had she was a nice woman. And she had a nice ordinary husband, very nice husband, who called himself the token earthling. Because there was a whole crowd of them, actually, from Venus, now that I think about it. And he was the token earthling. He just took it in a very sort of cheerful way. And they were kind of nice. They wandered around for a while. There was another woman who always used to call herself this unit of consciousness. This unit of consciousness would like more mashed potatoes. Never perceiving the delightful absurdity of the whole thing. It would be like, for on our side, like Master and Swamiji, don't even begin laughing, we'll never stop. Okay, here's more potatoes for this unit of consciousness. Would it like gravy also? You know, it's just the way that we play. But the truth is, you know, we are caught in this ego identification and in the likes and dislikes that bind us to our ego. I was reflecting, we were doing the purification ceremony earlier, and it begins with that part, I seek purification by the grace of God. And then on behalf of Master, the light bearer says, the Master says, open your heart to me and I will enter and take charge of your life. Now, I was just wondering, like, why the heart? I mean, it's sentimental to say, open your heart to me. This is what people say all the time. But this is more than sentiment when we're saying it there. I read, you know, fragments of science, which comes my way, you know, mostly through some little snippet on Facebook or something like that. But there was a study, fascinating study, that was done. They are discovering that the composition of the heart is very simple, very similar to the composition of the brain. And that they're really figuring out that, in fact, we think with our heart a lot more than they thought we did. And the way Master put it was not about the biological makeup, but it was about the fact that whatever emotional attachment we have, reason follows the feeling. Once the feeling is in place, we always find reasons. And the way Master puts it also is the likes and dislikes of the heart are what bind us to this fluctuating duality. This is the one I love. This is the one I don't love. This is my enemy from a long time ago. This is B, whom I, A, really love. And that is C, whom B has been loving for too long. And then all of this goes around. I need to be important. I need to be successful. I need to have money. I'm so afraid of this. I'm afraid of being alone. I'm afraid God will never send someone better. And all of these realities, this is what keeps us on the waves. And it always, Master wrote about it so fabulously, it almost works out. You see, if every lifetime were a complete disaster, we would repudiate this world much more quickly. But the problem is it almost works out. Every time. So we just think, tiny adjustment, just a tiny adjustment. You know, I'm just going to be a redhead the next time. Or I saw a picture of this movie star, just a grainy movie star picture. I don't know, I have any idea who she was. Her magnetism for being a movie star just jumped off the newspaper page at me. And I thought, my gosh, how many lifetimes has this woman, this unit of consciousness, focused her attention, you know, just refining and refining and refining that energy. Swamiji said once he was on a cruise ship, I think he was on a ship, and there was a woman on the boat there with them who happened to be a very famous model. And he said at one point, for some reason or another, he touched her. He handed her sweater or something like that. He said the instant he touched her, he said this. He didn't describe it as sexual, but just this enormous female magnetism came from her. You know, it's just like it was so powerfully cultivated in her, and that's why she moved right in and was a success and was so lucky. How many lifetimes? And the Masters watch us because they understand. They understand the disappointment that we experienced and the necessity to try to see if we can find a balance somewhere. And they understand so deeply that they just let us play it out and never leave us and never judge us. But the extent to which we open our heart, Master just lives in your heart. And he's in charge. That doesn't mean that he approves of everything you're doing, but he doesn't disapprove of it in the sense of judging us. He just knows. He knows where it's going, and he needs to be there to pick up the pieces when we finally get to the end of it. I remember once Swamiji had asked something of me, which was very righteous and very much for my own well-being and also simply beyond me to do. And out of sincere honesty, I finally had to say, "Sir, you made this suggestion to me and I'm not anywhere near it. I'm just not doing what you asked me to do." I don't think he took an extra breath before he said, "Well, so much for theory, let's deal with reality." And then immediately it was, "Okay, I understand. I understand your aspiration. I understand your limitation. And now let's go forward." Because that's all that matters. It doesn't make any difference where we're standing. It's so comfortable to realize that. It really doesn't make any difference where we're standing. It doesn't matter how deep the pit is or how far off the trail we've gotten. All we have to do is just face the right direction and try to just scoot one foot forward. Just one tiny thought toward the divine. You know, this world is so much bigger and different than we think it is, and we're so intertwined, and the masters are so utterly involved in our lives. This is the strange paradox of omnipresence, as they describe it, that infinitely large and infinitesimal, that every one of us is exactly the same in the divine reality. We cannot conceive of that because we are so bound by likes and dislikes. But this one is so attractive and this one isn't. You know, this one is so talented and this one isn't. And this one is so good and this one isn't. And we imagine falsely that God thinks like we do. It's really quite insulting when you think about it, you know. We loved Master from varying degrees of ego attachment, but the love he gave us was only the perfect love of God. I was standing once in a place in India called Deva Prayag, between Rishikesh and Badrinath, for those of you who know, heading up into the high Himalayas. On the way, we stopped, and you walk down all these steps, and there's this big platform area, and you get to right to the point where two major rivers converge. That's what a Prayag is where the rivers converge. Two powerful rivers come like that, and it being India, I love, there's just this cement platform, and you can just walk right out to the point. You know, no railing, nothing, no long disclaimer from the insurance company. You can just walk right out to the edge, and you can bloody well drown yourself if you want to. It's just your prerogative there. And it's very auspicious to bathe in the water. So in fact, there's little platforms, and you have a chain that you can hold on to, and you can stand in the water. I mean, it's, if you choose to be, it's dangerous as can be. When we went there, we had Jocelyn Black with us, who was about 6 feet tall, a very powerful, strong woman, and an EMT to boot. "Jocelyn, why don't you go stand there and like hold people, okay? We'll all feel a lot better," because we were all just cheerfully jumping in. And I went way, way, way out to the very, very edge and curled my toes on the very edge. I fear heights, but not water. So we stood there like this. I was standing there like this. And you know, everyone who stands on the edge of a high building, you know, or at the edge of busy traffic, the thought crosses your mind. It's not exactly a suicidal thought, but it's just the thought of, just a little step, and I would be somewhere else completely, wouldn't I? Like this. But I just stood there, and I watched that river flowing and down in this canyon, and everything about it was fantastic. And I just thought how easy it would be for me just to go into that water. And whoof, gone, just like that. And I was conscious of the fact that it would create a pretty big commotion back on land. You know, that if Asha just went to India and just disappeared into the river, that really didn't seem like a plan. But I could also feel in that moment the cosmos would go right on. You know, the ego identification that I have with this little body is intensely important to me. And my soul nature is intensely important to God. But all the little ups and downs, you know, what difference do they make? Swamiji said Master was trying to talk about the extreme impersonal nature of God. And Swami said that Master said, God eats people. And then Master went like this, like that. You know, here we are, this little unit of consciousness protecting itself. And God's just gobbling us up. Just gobbling us up. Because the only thing that matters, the only thing that matters, how much have we loved? How much have we returned to God and gurus in the form of everyone and everything around us of that perfect love that they have showered upon us? Nothing else matters. It's nice to try to succeed, because in trying to succeed, we master all those likes and dislikes. That's the whole point, you see. That's how we sort them out. God plants these ambitions in us, and we have to make the marriage a success. We have to raise the child. We have to make the idea work. We have to do that painting. And it's very important that we give 100% of ourselves to it. Look at the way Swamiji worked. Look at the way Master worked. Master even talked, I work all day. Because in doing that, we master ourselves. And we become channels for that perfect love of God. And then that's what pleases Him. God bless you.